Hello, welcome to Farmgate. I'm Finlow Costain, the Chief Executive of Farmwell. McDonald's UK and Ireland and FAI Farms have won Compassion in World Farming's prestigious Sustainable Food and Farming Award for their work on regenerative beef. This is a four-year project centred on adaptive multi-paddock grazing, but even 2 years into the transition, the results have been outstanding. So what are they? How have they been achieved? And what has FAI learned along the way? Well, that's in a moment, but just before we get properly started, I want to let you know that later in the programme, we'll also be talking about new regenerative agriculture training that's available online at fai.academy, and we'll even give you a Farmgate discount code to help you get started. But now, to discuss their award-winning work on AMP grazing, I'm joined by Claire Hill, FAI's Director of Regenerative Agriculture, and FAI's Assistant Farm Manager, Silas Headley-Lawrence. Hello both.
Hi.
Hi, Finlay.
Claire, you must be over the moon to have won this award, not least because it's you who's been driving this work from the start.
Yeah, over the moon is exactly the way to describe it. We're really pleased. Never did we expect to win so soon. In fact, to start with, we said, oh, no, we're not going to apply because we haven't got enough information. But in the end, we decided to go for it. And yeah, over the moon is exactly the way to describe it, how we feel.
And Silas, you're a newer member of the FAI farm team. Has this project delivered the outcomes that you expect?
Yeah, I would say so. I'm certainly not surprised. I'm new at FAI, but I have been farming regeneratively for a few years at least. The outcomes we've seen here at FAI are very similar to what I've seen in the past and also what I've witnessed from friends and other people in networks that are also farming in a similar system.
Fantastic. We're going to go into the details of what those outcomes are and what you've discovered. But before we do that, Claire, Compassion's Sustainable Food and Farming Award is specifically for FAI's and McDonald's work on adaptive multi-paddock grazing. But this is just one of many tools that's used by regenerative farmers. How does it fit into the regenerative mix?
Tools is a good way to describe it. With regenerative farming, we talk about a toolbox of different things, and it depends on your context, what you're trying to farm, what you want to farm. Maybe you're going to change that. And for us, it was about having a lot of grassland on the farm and wanting to improve the way that we farmed that. And so using adaptive multi-paddock grazing, so effectively making a grazing plan, but the building in gaps to make it adaptive. So when building in flood and drought, building in capacity, sorry, for like flood and drought and adapting and changing, not getting set to a certain plan is important.
When you say building in capacity, you're not talking about concrete.
No, not concrete. No, it would be, I think, just for us, even having a conversation of, okay, well, if it does burn off in early, what would we do? Would we buffer feed with hay? Would we be able to make use of a different piece of land? What if we rested this now? Would that provide us some gaps? And we don't necessarily make a decision about how we'll deal with those problems as they come up, but we've had a bit more of a conversation and a thought about how we feel and how we think we would best deal with them if they do come up.
And when you talk about, you know, managing flood and managing drought, you know, a lot of that is down to soil, isn't it? It's the soil carbon sponge that you're trying to revitalise.
Yeah, exactly that. Sponge is the key word. So for us, it's about holding on to our floodwaters or all the rain we get in the winter and holding on to it for longer through the summer months to prevent the kind of burn off that we've always traditionally had on this farm. But if we could get green grass growing all the way through our summer, then that's productivity right there, because normally we accept a kind of level of levelling off of our growth rate. So we just accept that our animals don't grow very much in the summer months, and that's because the grass burns off. So we're all about trying to improve the water holding capacity of our soil, and we do that through adaptive multi-paddock grazing. So a large number of animals for a short period of time, followed by a long rest period, allows the plant to recover and grow and have deep roots and to improve the soil structure through different plants being allowed to express themselves.
And presumably, if that grass is continuing to grow for longer, and then because you've moved the animals around, you're able to utilise grass in paddocks into the winter as well, that means that you're getting better growth rates for longer throughout the year.
Yeah, the thing that I think we've been so surprised with so quickly is how well our animals are performing. So we'll finish our first cattle this year in 16 months. In days gone by, we used to not be finishing. We'd start sending cattle at 20, 24 months. And we've reduced the level of inputs now because we're completely pasture-based and outside. Majority of animals are outside all year round. So our costs have come right down. It's not all of our animals finishing in 16 months, I should say. But certainly to start in 16 months and to have them all finishing through this summer means that we're going to be housed. If we do have to house anything, we'll be taking many fewer animals through next winter, which is going to be much better for the farm and for our cost base.
Silas, you're managing the farm on a day-to-day basis. When Claire talks about a lot of animals, you know, in smaller paddocks then being moved on, it's hard to visualise that. Are we talking about really densely packed animals in a tiny space?
I think it depends about what you're trying to achieve. It also depends on how much biomass is in each cell that you've made. You know, for instance, when we're calving, I very much like to give the cows and calves more space, move them less often, just so it's a little bit less hectic, stressful. There's more space for cows to go off and calve and with a bit of privacy. Whereas with the yearlings, maybe we'll get them a little bit denser, we'll move them more often, you know, daily, could even do multiple times a day move. I would never leave anything in the same cell for more than 4 days. That's usually because after 4 days in the growing season, the plants grazed off in the first day are often starting to regrow, and then the cattle will probably go back and graze those new shoots off. And that's when you start overgrazing plants. So the idea is if you have, you know, what might not even be a very large field, but would probably have a week to 10 days worth of grazing in it by conventional standards, if you can split that into two or three or four fields, and you know that you're not going to start overgrazing plants.
Just to give us a sense of the size of these paddocks and the size of the fields, most of us, I'm sure, you know, sort of talking and listening will know what an acre looks like. So how much of an acre is your average paddock, and how many cattle are you having in that average paddock?
Again, it depends on the size of the group. So at the moment, if you take a group of cows and calves, we have 25 cows with calves in one of our groups, and they
so
have,
that's about 50 altogether.
Yeah, they're in about a hectare move every day, so that's what 2.2 acres.
So they're really not crowded in, you know, it's just that they're not given a free range across, you know, a much larger field.
Yeah, they're very much allowed space, you know, especially when it comes to shade and water. They're not fighting for it, they all have their own space, their own kind of comfort zones, if you like, still there, as well as, you know, the ability to move around and graze. But what we're doing is trying not to give them so much space that they undergraze certain plants and overgraze others, or, you know, that they congregate in the same place for too long and cause compaction problems under certain trees. So it's just about making sure that they're in a smallish space on the grand scheme of a whole field for a short amount of time, where you can get greater animal impact, you'll get more trampling effect. You know, they'll get rising under the hedgerows, the trees, and they'll flatten docks and nettles and everything else.
And as you talk about it there, it strikes me that it really is about learning the behaviour of your animals and the way that your own land works. And that's why it's called adaptive multi-paddock grazing, because it will change. It's not going to be a set formula. Now, just I wonder how regenerative farming compares with the sort of traditional farming methods that people tend to get taught, you know, every day at agricultural college. So how does that compare in terms of the way that you're managing the farm, the things you do in an average day, the way the farm looks?
I would say regen is very much more visual, and as you said, adaptive and flexible. It's not very prescriptive. You know, you don't, cells aren't all the same size, and they're not all grazed for the same amount of days, and you're not going into the same amount of grass and leaving the same residual. And that's something you learn with time and experience. You kind of get your eye in of what you're trying to achieve, the outcomes you want once you move the cattle out of each cell. Was that the right size cell for that amount of cattle for that amount of time? And it might mean that, you know, you don't always move the cattle every morning at 9 o'clock. Maybe you move them in the morning one day, and then you move them in the afternoon another day, just so that you can get that residual that you like. Whereas I feel in conventional farming, it's very much more measuring and following a set of, you know, we put them in that field for a week, and then we move them into another field for a week. And those fields might be different sizes with different species of plants in the pastures and, you know, different grass covers and everything else. So yeah, regen is almost flipping things on its head. Plate meters don't really work. We tend to have grass that's too tall for plate meters to function. You know, we'll be leaving enough grass behind, where in more conventional systems, our residual would look like what farmers put cattle into the field at as their opening cover. And, you know, we certainly wouldn't graze as tight as many people would in a more conventional system.
And Claire, you've talked to me recently about the way in which, you know, you've actually brought local farmers and local people from villages around FAI onto the farm, almost because, you know, people have been starting to say, that's a bit of an untidy field, that grass is growing a bit high, you want to do something about that. And so you've had to actually physically reach out to people around you to explain what it is that you're doing so that they understand the changes on the farm.
Absolutely. We have to just keep reminding ourselves that nature doesn't do neat. And as farmers, we love neat. I don't think I ever really quite realised how much we did, but we like nice, even fields that have been grazed down with no weeds, weeds and everything tidy. And that people do, people that live around the farm, they think that it's gone to pot because we've got long grass all over the place and we're not managing our fields. That's the sort of terminology that gets used. Oh, you're not managing it anymore. Well, actually, we are managing it in a very detailed way, but just in a different way. Ruth Layton, the founder of FAI, was just here this morning, actually. And she says, I do understand. I just really struggle because it looks so messy. But look at all the butterflies and the insects and all the water we're holding down because it's not evaporating because we've got long grass. You just have to kind of get used to what a new type of beautiful looks like.
And that must have been difficult for you personally. I mean, you know, so I'm interested in your own personal journey because you come from a fairly traditional farming background. So how difficult has it been for you to get your head around a regenerative approach to agriculture?
Yeah, well, I did all the things that everyone does to start with, which is like, that won't work here. You know, that classic one. We can't do that on this farm. And in fact, Peter Bick, who's been on this podcast and is the kind of founder of Carbon Cowboys and big projects in the States, I even emailed him to that effect, you know, like, this is great, Peter. I get that you're well respected and your work is fantastic, but it'll never work here. And I don't know why, just over time, that's kind of worn down. I've been lucky that I've had access to training and support. So through the McDonald's project, of course, if we're going to transition the farm, we need to learn how to do that. And so we've had to have trainers and people help us with that process. I say coaching, and I don't think without that, I would have done it. But I would say now that I'm a kind of created some new farming friends. So I maybe don't talk about the way that we farm now with some of my traditional farming friends. I've got some kind of new farming friends as well. I still have those friends. We just don't talk about farming in quite the same way. So there's been a complete unlearn of everything I've learned at college and through my life and my dad, who's a farm manager through all of his life, to kind of relearn a new way and acceptance of there's something different to do now. And that whole piece has been hard. Yeah, hard.
You know, in the same way that you've had to get your head around this, you've had to win the argument for regenerative agriculture at FAI as well, because FAI is not just one amorphous mass of brain. There's lots of different people, lots of different thoughts and ideas. So just in the same way that other farmers may have to win their own family or business partners around to a new way of doing things, you've had to do the same. I wonder if you could talk to me a bit about the kind of pushback that you've had and how you made your way through that to deliver the changes that you wanted to see.
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, so I normally say, oh, we're different because we're not a family farm, but I've actually realised that we kind of are. I've got seven siblings as co-owners of FAI, and we bicker and argue as good as the rest of them, and we're all at a different place on our regenerative journey. I've been fully immersed in it because of this project and the work that I do, so I'm thinking differently to some of my colleagues that are in a different place. How have I navigated it? That's a really interesting one, and whether they might have a different view, but I think it's a combination of bulldozing at times and just knowing it's the right thing to do and having to do it so that you've then got something to show, because sometimes we can get a bit hamstrung with lots of conversations about what might be and what does this science show and what how does it compare to that, to just having a sense that it's the right thing to do, but also not doing too much of that, and then and kind of checking in and trying a few things. I think that's it. I want to try this idea. Let's just try this and see, and then review, and trying a few things and then looking at it. And the biggest thing has been for people to see it. So of course, we've been through this transformation during lockdown where we haven't been able to show people. And so I think maybe some of the, since people are able to start coming and seeing it for themselves again, that's when it changes. I've seen some big changes happen when people have visited and been immersed in it and gone, and there's this light bulb, especially seeing how the farm was and seeing the farm now. It looks very different. It feels different atmosphere even, and people to be immersed in that's where change has happened.
And winning this award with McDonald's for the work that you're doing, I mean, that must have helped to get people on side.
Yeah, no doubt. It's like, oh, okay, so it's not just Claire banging this drum, other people think this is important as well. And so that has definitely been really good recognition. I mean, in the last 12 months, the pace at which the conversation about regenerative agriculture has picked up has just been like nothing I've ever seen so far in my lifetime, I think, a change that's so quick. And so getting the award has kind of cemented that in that, yeah, there are organisations out there. So firstly, McDonald's committing to us in the first place, really, when we first started talking about this 18 months, 2 years ago, and back then to make that bold decision to say, yes, let's look at this. So that was the first step. And then for Compassion to now ratify that with this award, it just shows fantastic commitment that people are understanding it. So yeah, it's been really good.
Silas, it's not just at farm level that change has to happen, but at processor and retailer level as well. And a phrase that corporates like to use is shift the dial. And do you think this work and now this Sustainable Food and Farming Award from Compassion will help to shift the dial, not just in terms of McDonald's supply chains, but other livestock supply chains as well?
I think so. There's definitely a lot more interest from what I've seen and heard out in the conventional farming world, and also, as you say, further up the supply chain and what's going on in regen ag, both in the UK and globally. And, you know, whether that comes from a consumer level, which puts pressure on retailers to start doing 100% grass-fed lines in supermarkets, things like that, the clarity needs to come with. They're going to start labelling things as 100% grass-fed, and more of the supply chain's going to invest in this, and probably needs to be some kind of, not necessarily certification, but making sure that what is being sold to consumers as a product, 100% pasture-fed, organic, regenerative, whatever, those farmers that are selling that produce are achieving those outcomes. But yeah, you are right. It seems that from the very big corporates right the way down to consumers in general. And I think things like social media now, it's so easy and accessible for everyday people to now get a relationship with agriculture that they probably couldn't have had 10 years ago because of social media, Instagram, podcasts. And I think once that snowball starts going, and there's always conversations going around the media about climate change and food security and food nutrition, inevitably regenerative agriculture is going to come into those conversations, and more people outside of farming are going to become aware of it and interested in it. You hear a lot of nutritionists and well-respected people in the fitness world and all sorts talking about this kind of stuff, 100% pasture-fed, organic, paleo, and all these different terms that those products link into farms that are farming in some form regeneratively. Everything that's come previously tends to be a set of standards that to be certified as whatever, organic or something, you just need to do this and do that or not do that and have records to prove it. But I think the difference with regen is it all needs to be on an outcome-based measurement, not on a prescriptive do's and don'ts. You know, there might be multiple ways of achieving a similar outcome, but as long as it is physically improving your landscape, improving habitat, increasing carbon levels in the soil, building soil, making your farm more drought tolerant, flood tolerant, more productive on lower inputs, you know, higher animal welfare, all these things that Regen Ag seems to have a fix for, that's the outcome-based measurement that if there is going to be some kind of product labelled as regenerative certified or something like that, those outcomes are what are measured and not a prescription of how to do it.
Claire, as people, we change the way that we do things for many reasons, not least of which is education. And FAI has just opened a new online training portal, the FAI.academy. I was on it the other day and it looks fantastic. It's a really impressive website with a great offer. And I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit more about the academy. For example, who the training is aimed at and how people can access it.
We're kind of trying to do something for everyone that's interested in regenerative agriculture and sustainable food systems. I guess it's for people working in food supply chain or citizens that are just interested in where food comes from. And we've got a kind of introductory courses, or our ones we're starting with are around tilapia, on antimicrobial use in supply chains and regenerative agriculture, but with more to come in the future.
And I know that there's one that you're working on at the moment that's targeted at vets and how the role of the vet in the countryside may change as we go forward as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Regenerative agriculture for people working in the veterinary profession, written by vets for vets. We're working on that at the moment.
Claire, one of the new courses available at FAI.academy is the Citizen's Guide to Regenerative Agriculture. Now, this is 10 hours of self-led, interactive, multimedia training tailored, as you were saying, for anybody that's interested in food and where it comes from. Could you tell us a bit more specifically about that course and about the discount that you're offering for Farmgate listeners?
Yeah, I think it's a great course. firstly, just to say about our regenerative agriculture courses that we've written them after our early years of experience on the farm. So it's a kind of combination of information that's out there, technical information, other people's experiences, but also our experiences here that have kind of filled into that. So it's a kind of real and living course. And our Citizen's Guide to Regenerative Agriculture, we're really excited to launch that because people are what make change, and people out there want to know more and want to make different decisions about their food. So in order to help people understand, because the area is really complicated and it can be feel confusing, we've developed the course and we're offering 35% off for Farmgate listeners. You just need to go to fai.academy, select the Citizen's Guide course, and then use the code Farmgate when you register to get your 35% discount.
Which is fantastic. Now, Claire, I want to spend a bit of time thinking about the outcomes, you know, that we were talking about earlier, and how you actually monitor change. And you've mentioned the improvement to the land and to the amount of grass that's being produced. But how are you actually capturing data and monitoring this?
Well, that's the kind of exciting thing about the project. That's the bit that McDonald's are allowing us to do by sponsoring this programme, is that we're collecting about 60 different measures, so loads. And the reason we're collecting so many is so that we can identify the ones that are the best proxy measures, so that other people would only have, wanting to roll out this sort of system, would only have to look at a few. They're very much in the main focused on looking at our soil and looking at our land and seeing, are we regenerative? If we ask ourselves that question, we don't know until we look if our land is regenerating. So what are those indicators? So looking at infiltration rate of the soil, looking at percentage of bare soil, looking for evidence of whether water is being soaked into the soil or is running off the top, little bits of compaction. We're looking at our biodiversity, particularly around dung beetles and dung beetle activity. So the amount of time it takes for our dung to break down, plus actually getting into our dung and looking at types and ages of dung beetles. That's the type of things that we're monitoring.
And then is it just the dung beetles, or are you measuring the number of arthropods and the number of birds and butterflies and that sort of thing as well?
So we're kind of going for indicator species. There's so much we could measure. We're going for the indicator. So butterflies would be one that we are using. The reason is that there's a long ongoing study on the farm of butterflies. And so we're able to use that data to see the changes over time. But it's very difficult. I've tried thinking I could look for birds, but I'm not very good at identifying them and that sort of thing. So it can be difficult to monitor biodiversity, which is why we've gone with something that we can, like what can I as a farmer myself learn and to look at, and what is a good indicator. So if we've got good dung beetle populations, then we know that good things are happening. We're not doing lots of detailed measuring of all the different insects as much as we'd love to, because it's a really specialist area and we want the work that we're doing to be relevant and easily rolled out for other farmers.
And how are you capturing this data? Is it all on paper?
It's a combination, but a lot of it is going, what we found fantastically useful is a Soil Mentor app, because that allows you to record your location. It's really easy to a scoring system. So for example, on bare soil, like percentages, or a really like good guide to help me even learn. Like when I first started and I was thinking time taken for dung to break down, I don't really know, how do I measure it? How do I go about it? So we found Soil Mentor really, really useful for doing it. Some of it is still on paper, but that, yeah, Soil Mentor in the main. And also to say we went through Savory EOV, so the Savory Institute's Ecological Outcome Verification, in order to kind of have independent people come to the farm and see that what we were doing was improving the land and that our land is definitely regenerating.
And what's the name of that? Because I think that gives you a brand, it gives you a label that you're able to use, doesn't it?
Yeah, Land to Market is the label, but there are only 9 farms in the UK with Land to Market certification or EOVs. And so it's kind of not well known yet, but Silas was mentioning earlier about outcomes and set of standards. So yeah, there's nothing that they write that say you must do this. They come to the farm and they assess the land and they provide training in order to help understand what you might need to do on your farm to make the changes to get the outcomes that you're looking for. So it's a totally different way of certifying or thinking about the way that we manage land.
How does the cost of being a member of the Alan Savory Land to Market system compare with, for example, the costs of being part of Soil Association Organic?
They're about the same. We do both at the moment because I think it's still important because people understand organic. So it's important for us from a marketing point of view. But cost-wise, the certification is about the same.
Silas, one of the questions, and we touched on this just a little bit earlier on, but one of the questions around AMP grazing or adaptive multi-paddock grazing centres on the fact that the cattle are more restricted than they would be in a standard field and that this may impact on their welfare. Do you think this is actually an issue, or it's rather just something that people think might be an issue?
I think it's a perceived issue. You know, if you were in a 100-hectare field and you had cattle restricted to the centre of that field in the middle of summer and it's 35 degrees and there was no shade and shelter, then yes. But the idea is that the keyword is adaptive. So our cells aren't always the same shape, the same size. I always plan them that there is shade and shelter. You know, they've always got access to water. They're always moving out of that cell before they've run out of grass. You know, visually, many farmers would go in and think, oh, there's another day or two's grazing in this, maybe more. But the cattle know they want to move, but they're not irritated that they need to move. They're content. They know the drill. They know the routine. They see you coming. They stand at the fence and they come through. And the behavior, you know, they're very relaxed and quiet and docile. And because they see you every day as well, and you're moving them physically every day, they get very used to people. They get very used to you and the routine. And, you know, linking in with what Claire was saying, which is why I think farmers get so excited by this stuff when they start doing it, but also people who aren't farmers that come to these farms and see what's going on, is you talk about these visual clues, but also the data sets and the outcomes. And if you can achieve average daily live weight gains across the year of 1.4 kilos or more and finish animals at 16 to 20 months, every day you're driving around the farm, you feel like you're on a domestic safari. And, you know, that's what gets people excited. They're seeing things, and whether they're barn owls or foxes and badgers and insects. And I've been told there's lots of plant species that have been found here at FAI that various people that have come to study these things have got very excited about because they're very rare. And I felt I was quite good at these kind of plant IDs. Now I'm a bit like a school kid again. There's so many of them there. I don't know what most of them are. You know, we might not be measuring all of that, but if I'm going out every day and it's an exciting environment to be in and I'm seeing things that make you feel good, you're seeing nature and you're seeing ecosystems working and thriving, as well as achieving these efficiencies in terms of daily live weight gains and soil health, then it's a no-brainer why this all adds up, and people do get very invested in it.
And when you're seeing an increasing diversity in the swarm, I mean, if we're talking about health and welfare, these things are very interconnected, aren't they? And as you have more plants growing, you're attracting in different insects and some insects which will predate on others. And therefore, you're likely to, it's self-medication sort of makes it sound a bit hippie, but actually what you're doing is creating, restoring balance in there so that you have healthier animals. And that in itself means that there is better welfare.
Exactly. The more diversity in the pastures, as well as having access to browse on hedgerows and trees, you know, every plant plays its role in an ecosystem, whether that's they're great at breaking up soil compaction or they're very high in minerals or tannins. Cattle know what plants to go to self-medicate. And the more diversity you can achieve, the more opportunity they have to self-medicate. And again, that links in with your own input costs reduced because there's less need for vet and med and mineral costs. And yeah, that whole ecosystem approach that you said, you just create the habitat for those insects and the whole supply, the whole food chain above that benefits, which is why you get this whole mosaic of, you know, wildlife from the top of the chain to the bottom, and everything is just working in tandem in sync with nature.
And you mentioned hedges there. And of course, being able to display natural behavior is the cornerstone of measuring and monitoring farm animal welfare. And I understand that you've been actually taking fences down so that the animals are able to access the hedges, and you know, there's a greater range of nutrition within the hedge itself, and they're also bringing some of those nutrients back out into the field.
Exactly. And the key is that we're not allowing the animals to stay in the same place for so long that they end up damaging a hedgerow or they end up damaging a tree. You know, they're probably only there in and around it for a day, maybe three, four at the absolute most. And it all comes back to that visualization. Move them before things become a problem. Move them before they overgraze, move them before they damage a hedgerow, just let them go in, browse a little bit, move, they're onto the next cell, into the next hedgerow. And then they're not coming back to that cell, which is a big key of it. It's the recovery periods that follow these short-term grazings. They're not coming back to that cell for 40, 50, 60 days, even more. Sometimes we might leave an area to rest for 6 months. And that is really important here to achieve those outcomes of that soil health and the biodiversity and recovery and the deep root systems and the huge amounts of biomass you can then grow above the soil as well.
And from that perspective, it sounds as though physically being on the quad bike or walking in and around the farm on a daily basis is really important to understanding the stage that a particular paddock or a particular animal is at. at, you know, on any given day of the year. And so it's really putting the human back into farming, which is fantastic. So one of the things that FAI does is to take risks, learn from the process, and then communicate that knowledge so that other farmers are able to make changes with more confidence. In terms of regenerative agriculture, how important do you think that role is in terms of making a national and global transition?
It's massively important because, in my opinion, the agricultural food system in the last 100 years is dysfunctional. It's producing food that's less nutrient dense in a way that is degrading land and having a negative impact on habitats and polluting waterways and everything else. So if we need to shift away from that and do something different, you have to take risks. You have to do things that maybe farmers haven't done in the last few generations. A lot of regen ag is new thinking. A lot of it is embedded in old traditions, but maybe now with a bit more of understanding about the processes and the science and the biology. Another good thing with regen is it is snowballing, and there is a lot of it going on in places like the States and Australia and places like that that have much more, you know, they're under more pressure climate-wise. They're much drier, hotter. They need to do something different. They've been forced to do it. And it is much easier to follow suit or follow to take those first steps of shifting to regen ag when you hear about people that have been doing it for 20, 30 years and you hear their stories about how things on their farms have improved and what they've done and how they've achieved that. And yeah, it's a very important point, but it is also difficult to take what someone has done in Central Australia, and maybe that's not the same way that you would do that in the UK. So it's very important that you find what works in your environment, in your system, on your farm, and take little bits and learn from other people that have been doing similar things around the world.
So it's not just about reducing your own costs, increasing your own profits, and increasing the breadth of wildlife on FAI's farm itself. It's about de-risking regenerative agriculture for other farmers who are able to learn from what you're doing. It's fascinating to hear the way that you're describing it there, Silas. Claire, just finally, we've talked about the nuts and bolts of AMP grazing today and about some of the outcomes. But for you as a human being, I wonder, you know, because you came from that mainstream background, do you feel that your relationship with your livestock and with the land has changed as a result of your transition to regen agriculture?
Certainly, yeah. It's kind of more than changed. It's sort of completely overhauled. I just look at everything so differently. When I look at animals and the land now, I'm looking for feedback. So it's like Silas said earlier, oh, we grazed that for a bit too long, but we had to leave them in there because we needed to bring them in for TB testing or something like that. How is that being different? How does that recover in the weeks to come? And what is it telling us? When I see weeds now, when I see things I'm not used to, it's like, what does that mean? What's that telling us? When you see the animals with maybe there's some that are holding on to their summer coat a bit more, why is that happening? What is it about our system that's not in balance? It's totally changed my relationship and I view it completely differently. Humphrey, who works with us, used to say that when you start seeing things differently, the things that you see change. And that totally sums it up for me. When I look out across a field now, I'm looking for different things and I see different things. As a human being, what's changed for me is that I felt before like we were on a treadmill and it was always this next lambing, it can't be as wet, it won't be as wet, we won't have this worm problem next year, this will be better, we'll tweak that here and we'll tweak that there and we won't have the same problem. But just new problems kept arising and it was like this never-ending whirlwind, whereas now it just feels, I mean, we still work hard and there's a lot to do, but it's it just feels like there's a bit of space and we're excited because we know that we can look forward to things. So even if we have the wettest winter on record, that's okay because we've planned for it and we do it in a different way now that means that we're not relying on it not being the wettest winter on record in order to survive. So in summary, very long answer there, but it's completely changed my relationship with the animals and the land.
Thank you so much. And I love the word that you used at the beginning of your answer, which was conversation. I love the idea of it being an ongoing conversation with the livestock and the land. Thank you both. That's all we have time for. I'd like to thank my guests, Claire Hill and Silas Headley-Lawrence. If you'd like to find out more about the Citizen's Guide to Regenerative Agriculture, please visit fai.academy. And if you'd like to take the course, please use the code FARMGATE when you register to get that 35% discount. If you've enjoyed listening, please come back and listen to more. Tell your friends, like us, review us and share our links. FarmGate is a partnership project for Farmwell and FAI Farms. We're funded by Sankalpa, and you can join the conversation on Twitter by searching for FarmGate Podcast. I've been Finlow Castain. Bye for now.